This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Back in 1774, most people living in the 13 colonies saw themselves as British subjects and had almost no thought of independence from the crown. 2 years later, as we all know, the Declaration of Independence was signed here in Philadelphia and a new country was born. Our guest, acclaimed historian Richard Beeman, has written a book about the delegates who met in this city for the First and Second Continental Congresses. The book is titled Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor. These delegates were strangers in a strange city, and in those 22 months they discussed and argued and debated and eventually compromised to create this historic document. Beeman writes about the eccentric cast of characters, the issues that consumed them, and the events that influenced the outcome. He's the John Welsh Centennial Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, has written a bunch of books about the American Revolution and the Constitution. And Richard Beeman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's wonderful to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So take us back, I guess, to these 13 colonies. This is the late 1700s. And these were British subjects living here miles, many, many thousands of miles from home.
They were loyal British subjects. If you went into Benjamin Franklin's dining room in the 1750s, you would have seen a portrait of King George II hanging there. All over the American colonies, Americans worshipped their association with the British Empire. The anecdote that I love to tell is that of Benjamin Rush, who was this Philadelphia physician who ultimately was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a great American patriot. But in the year 1768, at a time when the Americans were quarreling with the British over the right of the British to tax them, Rush finds himself in London in the House of Lords, and he sees the throne of King George III. And he's just overwhelmed with emotion. Somehow, I have no idea how he managed to do this, he persuades his guide to let him sit in the throne. I really can't imagine that today. And so he sits in the throne, and he writes that his brain just kind of exploded with emotion. Such was his love of the king and all of the things that the king stood for.
And even going back to those years of obviously 13 colonies, did they view each other as kind of independent colonies of the British Empire?
I think they didn't think much about one another. Their focus, really, if you lived in Georgia, your focus was in London. If you lived in Philadelphia, your focus was in London. They really did not have a lot of interaction with one another, and frankly, for most of that time, the weight of government, whether it was colonial government, there was no American government, or the British government, was very light. So they mostly didn't think
them
much
alone.
About yeah.
But it seems that Massachusetts, this sort of I would say more of a cauldron of protests, began to protest the Stamp Act of 1765, the Coercive Acts. Yeah. That seemed to be the spark.
Yeah, those New England fanatics, particularly if you were a Philadelphian, which tended to be, frankly, the most conservative city in America at the time when it came to affairs with Great Britain. Those Bostonians really riled things up. And the real turning point in this conflict with the British, which began in 1763 when the British decided that Americans had to pay their fair share of the cost of the British Empire and started to put into place a program of taxation. But the real turning point did occur on December 16, 1773 in Boston, when those three groups of, quote, Mohawk Indians, very badly disguised as Mohawk Indians, boarded the three East India Company ships and threw 92,600 pounds of tea in the Boston Harbor. And that really ticked off the British Parliament. In terms of the absolute value of commodities destroyed, it wasn't such a big deal. But that just proved to Parliament that they had to draw the line.
An act of true defiance, I guess, against the empire, against the crown.
Exactly. And Sam Adams was the real bad guy in their view in that case, although he denied it. They thought he was behind it all.
Eventually, there's the First Continental Congress. These, as you describe in this book, these strangers, they did not know each other, meet in Philadelphia, this strange city. What did they come originally to do?
Well, John Adams called them a gathering of strangers, and then a couple of weeks into the session, as they were disagreeing on things, he said they had as much in common as a dozen belligerent ambassadors from a dozen warring European nations, or a conclave of cardinals selecting a pope. In fact, the Continental Congress was conceived by relatively conservative Philadelphians and New Yorkers as a way of calming down the Bostonians. The Bostonians wanted to act by boycotting British goods, not go to war yet, but really confront the British. And so the Continental Congress was initially conceived as a means of drawing together the most well-educated, the calmest, most rational political leaders of America to try to work out some path toward reconciliation. Of course, in the 22 months that the Continental Congress met, that's not what happened.
Well, indeed, and we'll get to all of that. But there was a, I guess, a boycott of British goods. I mean, that was one of the things that came out of this meeting.
That's right. During the First Continental Congress, which met for only 7 weeks from early September to the end of October, really a coalition of New Englanders and Virginians pushed through the Congress a thoroughgoing boycott of British goods, which really was a big step forward, an escalation of the conflict. It, first of all, was a clear message to the British that the Americans meant business, but it also gave control over the enforcement of that boycott, not to wealthy merchants in places like Philadelphia, but local committees of ordinary citizens who were going to be sure that everybody obeyed it.
And you read about King George and the fact that on one hand he was described by some as a kind of a bumbler, on the other hand as an autocrat who wanted much more control over the British Empire.
Yeah,
how do you see him?
Well, he's a complicated person. Of course, by 1776, he was in the minds of all Americans simply a devil and a tyrant. And since later in his life he also went insane, that there's also this view that many Americans have that he was nuts as well. Listen, George III, although he probably wouldn't qualify for membership in Mensa, he was a reasonably intelligent young king. He became king at age 23, but he knew that he was going to become king from the age of about 6 or 7 years old. So he had a great burden of responsibility on him. And if he had a fault, it was being overly conscientious, overly involved in overseeing this conflict with the Americans.
Unlike, I guess, his parents or maybe even his grandfather.
Yeah, well, King George III's father died when King George III was a young man, so that's why he knew he was going to become king at an early age. His grandfather, King George II, barely spoke English. So King George II wasn't paying a lot of attention to what was going on in Parliament, but George III was.
Take us back again to, I guess, Philadelphia at this time, and this was, I guess, the biggest city, the most sort of business-oriented city. It was on a port. That would help, I would think, back in those days.
Yes, it was the fastest-growing city in America. It was the largest city in America. It's often said that it was the second-largest city in the British Empire next to London, but believe me, there's a pretty big difference between London and the 28,000 people who lived in Philadelphia. It had a very dynamic economy based largely on the legal exportation of farm goods from the Pennsylvania countryside. So in a sense, Philadelphia and southeastern Pennsylvania is an area which is doing just fine under the British Empire. And I think it's fair to say that British policies post-1763 perhaps didn't affect them quite as much as they did a town like Boston.
Meaning that they, and maybe explaining why many of the delegates from Pennsylvania were more conservative, you know, less willing to cut ties or even sort of end this British control over the colonies.
I think that's right. Now, I don't want to get too academic here, but Massachusetts was a royal colony with a royal governor, which meant that they were directly under the authority of the crown. Pennsylvania was a proprietary colony, a member of the William Penn's family, fairly lightly governed them. So they didn't have that direct personal conflict with the crown, I think, that Massachusetts did.
You had a piece recently in the Philadelphia Inquirer comparing some of the what happened in Philadelphia when the delegates met for the first and second Continental Congress and comparing to what goes on in Washington. And one of the things you said is that at least these delegates in this city spent time together. They ate together. They drank together. They knew each other, even if they were initially strangers in a strange town.
Absolutely. They may have started as a gathering of strangers, but they're living in these small boarding houses, sometimes sharing bedrooms together. And then after their session in Carpenter's Hall during the first Congress, they go off to City Tavern and eat and drink together, and they got to know one another, and they got to see what they had in common, to respect one another. You know, I'm old enough, Marty, that I can remember a time in Washington, D.C., when our politicians on both sides of the aisle, Everett Dirksen and Lyndon Johnson, the Senate minority and majority leaders, or even after that, Tip O'Neill and President Reagan, even though they might have some vociferous battles in public, after it was all over, they'd go out and eat and drink together and find a way to work together. And that's what I think maybe our present-day members of Congress need to learn from the founders.
Well, and what you're also saying is that these were people that had relationships with each other. I mean, it was more than just a passing acquaintance.
That's exactly right. Now, you know, there are a couple of grumpy delegates to the Congress who weren't always as friendly as they might have been. Maybe we'll get to this a little later. But, you know, John Adams, who loved to think of himself, as he was described, as the Atlas of Independence, that he was basically responsible for all of the good things that happened to America, he had very little tolerance for some of these Philadelphians like John Dickinson, who wanted to go a little more slowly.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll pick up on both John Adams and John Dickinson. Again, our guest today in Radio Times is Richard Beeman. He's the John Welsh Centennial Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. Spent 45 years as a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and he has a new book. It's called Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor, about the 22 months leading up to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Westchester University Online Studies. From an accredited MBA to a master's in special education, convenient and flexible degree and certificate programs are available in several subject areas such as business, health, and education. For more information or to submit an application online, wcupa.edu/grad. Westchester University. Learn more.
When Peter Hook first met Joy Division bandmate Ian Curtis, he didn't notice the word hate written on his jacket.
Amazingly, I saw the front of him before I saw the back of him. And if somebody had said to me, "What do you think that young man's got written on his back?" I would have thought it was a picture of kittens.
Peter Hook remembers Ian Curtis and Joy Division this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Christine Ha is the blind cook who won TV's Master Chef with dishes her mama used to make.
I'm cooking Vietnamese comfort food. It's a catfish braised in a clay pot.
She's now out with a new cookbook that teaches you how to do the same. Come to the table and we'll share next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1:00. on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with historian Richard Beeman, who says that today's politicians could learn a thing or two from the delegates who met in Philadelphia more than 200 years ago. This was a turbulent 22-month period culminating in the Declaration of Independence, July 1776. And again, the subject of his new book, which we are talking about, called Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor. Well, let's talk about some of these personalities, as we say today. John Adams, passionate, as you said, Atlas of Independence. Was he just as irritating as hell as some of his critics seem to say?
Well, you know, I must say I should be grateful to John Adams. One, he really did drive the move for independence forward relentlessly during those 22 months. And particularly important for an historian like me is that every day he systematically broke the rule of secrecy of the Congress by writing to his wife Abigail, telling her what was going on. So we actually know a lot about what was going on in the Congress because John Adams was violating the rules.
Couldn't keep his mouth shut.
But honestly, I think there were times when many of the delegates wanted to wring his neck because he was just so relentless in pushing his agenda. And he could be pretty unkind to those who disagreed with him. You know, One of the things I like to do at this stage of my career is to move from the 18th century to the 21st century. So I like to imagine who the 21st century counterparts of our founding fathers would be. And I think John Adams' 21st century counterpart is Barney Frank.
Oh.
That, you know, Barney Frank is really smart, Harvard graduate like John Adams, passionate, but can be pretty abrasive.
Thinks
at times
he's right.
As well, that's right.
Well, someone else whom you write about, and people here in Pennsylvania should know this person, the Pennsylvania delegate, a guy named John Dickinson, who you describe or others describe in your book as maddeningly moderate.
I think probably many Philadelphians know of John Dickinson. Most Americans, I think, have never heard of John Dickinson. In 1774, I think the two most well-known Americans in relation to America's conflict with England were the radical Sam Adams in Boston and John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, the author of a series of pamphlets called Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania, which were a very intelligent, eloquent defense of American rights under the British Constitution. So he comes into the Continental Congress deeply respected, far more better known than John Adams. But Dickinson, unlike John Adams, deeply believes in America's connection with the mother country, is a passionate devotee of the, quote, true principles of the English Constitution. So Dickinson believes that if the Continental Congress can only go that extra mile to persuade Parliament and ultimately the king that America's constitutional position under this unwritten English Constitution is the right one, that they can reach some kind of reconciliation. So Dickinson, because he's eloquent, because he's deeply respected, frequently slows the path of the Continental Congress toward independence down.
But did he fear that independence might lead to conflict among the then, you know, this young country?
Well, at the beginning, what he mostly wanted was just a reconciliation, and so Americans could be happy and liberty-loving subjects of the British king. As that became more and more difficult, after Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill, and the military conflict escalated, Dickinson could see that the room for negotiation was narrowing. But he was very much afraid of, and this is why he is maddeningly moderate, at least to John Adams, that too precipitous a move toward independence could amount to American defeat. that the Americans weren't prepared to win a war with the British. They hadn't yet formed alliances with nations like France and Spain. And he was indeed afraid that these 13 colonies, as 13 independent states, might not be able to cooperate. So he, on July 1st, 1776, gave a long and, for him, passionate, because in general he was very moderate, speech arguing against independence, and indeed on July 2nd voted against independence.
But what's interesting is after that he does fight for the rebels.
Right, and this in a way is maybe another lesson that passionate partisan members of Congress might try to learn from. So Dickinson, having spoken so passionately against independence, when the vote was held on July 2nd, and by the way, when the delegates went to vote on July 2nd, they'd done a straw vote on July 1st. 9 colonies had been in favor. Pennsylvania had been opposed. South Carolina had been mildly opposed. New York had abstained because their legislature wouldn't let them vote for independence. And Delaware was divided. So they did not have anywhere near unanimity. But between July 1st and July 2nd, pretty much everybody but Pennsylvania had come around. And John Dickinson, even though he still fervently believed that this was the wrong thing to do, and having spoken so passionately against it on July 1st, wasn't prepared to change his mind. But what he and one of his Pennsylvania colleagues, Robert Morris, did was go and stand behind the bar. That's not a bar at City Tavern, Marty.
Right.
That is, if you go into the Assembly Room of Independence Hall today, you will see this bar that separates visitors or spectators from the actual members of the Congress who are deliberating. And so he stepped outside of the voting area of the Assembly Room and allowed a bare majority of Pennsylvania delegates to vote in favor of independence, making it possible for Thomas Jefferson later to talk about the unanimous declaration of the United States.
So who would play John Dickinson in your mental movie?
I'll tell you something. Honestly, on the train coming into Philadelphia today, I was thinking about this very question. And I have a problem here. What I'm looking for is a moderate Republican, Marty. But I can't find
a bit of an endangered species
a moderate Republican member of the House or Senate who quite fits Dickinson's role.
Let me ask you about Richard Henry Lee, because you write in this book that he really was overshadowed by the delegates from Virginia, including Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, Patrick Henry as well. But it seemed that Richard Henry Lee was a very persuasive arguer for independence.
Richard Henry Lee was the Sam Adams and John Adams' closest ally through those whole 22 months. And Richard Henry Lee was in Virginia in May of 1776. He helped push through the Virginia House of Burgesses a resolution requesting that the Continental Congress declare independence. On June 7th, Richard Henry Lee appeared before the Continental Congress and formally introduced that resolution for independence. So Richard Henry Lee was really the one who got things going. It's very possible, had Richard Henry Lee stayed in Philadelphia, that he would have been asked to write the Declaration of Independence, not Thomas Jefferson. But Richard Henry Lee felt that he had a higher priority, which is go back to Virginia and help Virginia write its new constitution for the independent state of Virginia.
So he left. Well, and Thomas Jefferson at the time, I guess, was less well known than some of these other figures?
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson was not elected to the First Continental Congress. He wasn't a backbencher exactly in the Virginia legislature, but he's probably not in the top 10. He was elected to the Continental Congress in the summer of 75, served for a couple of months, replacing, actually, Peyton Randolph, who had become ill, and then came back to Virginia and didn't come back to the Congress until the very end of May of 1776. But lo and behold, on June 11, 1776, Congress, and when they appointed committees, they voted to see who would be the members of the committees. And so the Congress voted on a five-person committee, with the person receiving the largest number of votes being appointed chair of the committee. And Thomas Jefferson, this relatively new delegate, relatively unknown, was made chairman of the so-called Committee of Five.
And that's Richard Beeman, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor, The Forging of American Independence, 1774 to 1776. He's Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm jumping around here, but I want to ask you about this embargo. And part of the embargo, you write, this is the Articles of Association, an embargo against slaves or slavery. And I thought that was an interesting little piece of history, of course, part of our dark legacy here in the United States.
That's right. You know, one of the great paradoxes of our founding is that all of our founders said that we were a nation born of liberty. Yet we were a nation that was half slave, half free. And indeed, in 1774, every one of the 13 colonies permitted slavery to exist. Massachusetts would be the first colony to abolish slavery. But by 1776, or by 1774-75, when the embargo was enacted, most colonies really were beginning to think that they could do without slavery. And so included in the embargo was, and South Carolina and Georgia, which were the two colonies that were still importing slaves in the largest numbers, they somewhat reluctantly supported this as well, that they would put an end to the African slave trade.
And just quoting here from your book, the delegates pledged to, quote, neither import nor purchase any slave imported after the first day of December next, after which time we will wholly discontinue the slave trade, and going on from there.
That's right. It was a pledge that they did not remain true to, alas, because, of course, they continued to, Americans continued to import slaves until the year 1808, 20 years after the Constitution was adopted. But it is interesting. There are delegates from the South who speak passionately against slavery in the Continental Congress, that they do believe it is immoral. So many delegates do see this contradiction between their proclamations in favor of liberty and the holding of slaves. But if I may, Marty,
please.
I just have to, because this is the saddest bit of that contradiction. In November of 1775, the royal governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, who found himself, he had very few British troops in Virginia to hold off the rebellion that was going on in Virginia. So he was desperate. And so he issued a proclamation to all slaves who deserted their masters to fight on the side of the British, a proclamation freeing those slaves if they would do that. And many slaves did that. There was a battle soon thereafter fought, the slaves being very poorly trained. It was a disaster for the British Army, aided by these escaped slaves. So it didn't work out militarily for Lord Dunmore. The great irony is that if there was any doubt that Virginia slave owners had that their liberties were being threatened by the British, it was Lord Dunmore's proclamation promising to free their slaves.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Getting a very important history lesson about the years 1774 to 76 with our guest, Richard Beeman. Let's get, looks like B from Downingtown to join us on Radio Times. And B, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question. Supposedly, my husband is descended from Thomas Fitzsimmons, and I'm wondering if Thomas Fitzsimmons did anything at the convention other than just sign his name.
Well,
there's a lot riding on this. Yeah,
now,
I've
always pronounced it Fitzsimmons because there's only one M. And he was actually a member of the Constitutional Convention of 1787, which drafted the Constitution. And B, I'd love to be able to tell you that he had done something other than signing his name. But at least in my research thus far, he did not give any speeches in the convention, as far as I know. I'm sorry to have to deliver that news to your husband.
B, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, and that phone number 1-888-477-9499. I'm interested too in the sort of the back and forth, the toing and froing, I guess, that led up to the Declaration. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Olive Branch petition, and this was to the British or to the monarchy. What was that about?
Well, actually, Marty, I'm sorry
you
to contradict you. Well, I have, but it was John Dickinson
who wrote the
Olive Branch petition. And this was the last-ditch effort to appeal to the king for reconciliation. John Adams was just furious. Now, Jefferson, to his credit, because Jefferson had a very different temperament than Adams, Jefferson also didn't like this extra step trying to appeal to the king for reconciliation. But Jefferson recognized that Dickinson deserved that extra step. And so it was only when the king really rejects the Olive Branch petition, in fact declares the colonies in a state of rebellion, that's the point in which independence is looking more and more inevitable.
And a kind of a turning point, I guess, when the king rejects this
That's
Olive
right.
Branch.
That's right. Although, you know, again, what's interesting is that from January of 1776 to July of 1776, all avenues of reconciliation have closed. The king has rejected the Olive Branch petition. A Parliament's passed something called the Prohibitory Act, basically declaring war on the American colonies. Yet the colonies still take more than 6 months to make that final step. And that's the emotional and psychological leap that they had to make. And at this point, I do need to mention, I don't know whether we'd call him a Philadelphian, but he lived in Philadelphia for a brief time. That's Tom Paine, who arrives in Philadelphia on November 30th, 1774. And on January 10th, 1776, writes Common Sense. And here are people like John Dickinson who are saying that if only the British would return to the true principles of the English Constitution, everything would be okay. But nope. Tom Paine said that was Constitution was good for the dark and slavish times in which it was created, but not now.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll pick up on that after this short break. Richard Beeman, our guest today on Radio Times, and he's got a new book called Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, seduction and power, desire and passion are the themes of Venus in Fur at Philadelphia Theater Company. Playwright David Ives tells the darkly comedic tale of Vanda, a talented young actress determined to land the lead in a new play based on the classic erotic novel Venus in Fur. Vanda's emotionally charged audition for Thomas, a gifted but demanding playwright, becomes an electrifying game of cat and mouse that blurs the lines between fantasy and reality. Venus in Fur runs May 24th through June 23rd at the Suzanne Roberts Theater. Tickets at philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
So how does Mel Brooks feel about being on Fresh Air?
Public radio. I mean, this is my career. I'm finished. It's over. I'm picking up cigarette butts.
Mel Brooks on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mental illness affects the entire family. How to explain to children when their father can't get up to go to work or mom cries all the time? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll discuss how families can cope, how parents can parent, and what resources are available for families affected by mental illness. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, historian Richard Beeman is our guest. He's written a book about the delegates who met in Philadelphia for the First and Second Continental Congresses. The book is titled Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor. He writes about these delegates who met for 22 months. They discussed, they argued, they debated, and created the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You mentioned Thomas Paine and Common Sense, but also should be said that John Hancock, also a very important player, if I can use that word, two very different men, I would say. Yeah.
John Hancock was the richest merchant in Boston, and possibly one of the biggest smugglers in Boston as well. He was a man who loved fancy dress. He drove around Boston in a gold coach, but apparently the merchant seamen who worked for his merchant company loved him.
Wow.
They thought that that was a sign that they were in for, you know, good salaries and things. He was a man with a fairly large ego. I think it's fair to say that he and John Adams did not always get along terribly well. John Adams, there was some thought that John Hancock, rather than George Washington, would be appointed a commander-in-chief of the Continental Army.
Oh, wow.
Hancock had no military experience whatsoever, but he thought it was a kind of prestigious position. And Adams was just furious at the very thought that Hancock would aspire to this. But yes, Hancock, who is president of the Continental Congress, which means presiding officer, not chief executive, does moderate the proceedings that lead to independence. Whereas Tom Paine is an impoverished Englishman, arrives in Philadelphia with no money at all, but a letter of recommendation, a letter of reference from Ben Franklin, whom he had met in Philadelphia, and that is what enables Tom Paine to get a job with a Philadelphia printer, writing columns for something called the Pennsylvania Magazine, and then very shortly after his arrival, writes this earth-shaking pamphlet that literally changed the world, Common Sense.
And the kind of basis upon which the Declaration was written, do you think?
Well, no, actually. Common Sense gives Americans the psychological and emotional power to declare their independence. It just tosses out the English Constitution as worthless. It makes fun of the very idea of the monarchy. How ridiculous. It makes fun of the idea of a tiny island ruling, you know, reigning over an entire continent. He says, you know, you could imagine maybe a continent ruling an island, but not vice versa. So Paine helps Americans emotionally make the leap. But Jefferson's Declaration is a very different kind of document. It is a philosophical document rehearsing for Americans the natural rights of mankind. It is a diplomatic document aimed at getting the French and the Spanish to aid the Americans during the Revolutionary War. But the main body of it is a lawyerly document. It's a bill of indictment against the evil King George III, and those 27 specific grievances, all aimed at King George III. And those are aimed at violations of the English Constitution. So although Jefferson was an admirer of Common Sense, he didn't really use the same argument. He was still arguing as a lawyer under the true principles of the English Constitution.
Well, let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Charlotte from Freehold, New Jersey. Charlotte, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi,
hi there,
Professor. I love to watch The Madness of King George III. And somewhere, I think, at the end, there's a comment saying that he did spend the rest of his life regretting the loss of the colonies. And I keep thinking, is there a book I'd like to read more personally about that? Can you explain or expand on that?
Well, I can tell you, but I'm unfortunately I'm forgetting the title. But I'm plugging the work of a fellow historian who has just come out with a study of the British perspective on the American Revolution through King George III, and the author's name is Andrew O'Shaughnessy.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy.
Yes.
We're going to try to Google that right away and see if we can get the title for you. So there is some scholarship on this particular issue.
Absolutely. And of course, Andrew O'Shaughnessy is sort of both sides of the Atlantic in his view. There are, of course, lots of British historians who are more sympathetic to George III's point of view.
Charlotte, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Samantha from Haddonfield has to say. And Samantha, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi thanks for fielding my call.
You're welcome.
So I know that in Britain, abolition in the colonies didn't become enacted until about 1810 and wasn't final until 1836. And the colonies were really profitable for the British Empire. So why did they consider Lord Dunmore's policy of abolition in the Virginias as a serious threat?
Oh, interesting.
Well, it wasn't just it wasn't Lord Dunmore's policy of abolition. It was basically encouraging a slave revolt against these American masters, these Virginia masters. So that was a direct threat, not only to their economic well-being, because slaves had value, obviously, but to their security. So there was nothing the British could have done that would have been more terrifying to Americans in the southern colonies than encouraging slave rebellion.
Samantha, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You include here something that John Adams wrote in his autobiography, and this was about, you know, who was going to write the Declaration of Independence. I'm going to read it because I have to say it's charming. And this is why Thomas Jefferson was chosen, according to John Adams. And he writes that he was a Virginian and I was a Massachusettsian, that he was a Southern man and I a Northern one, that I had been so obnoxious from my early and constant zeal in promoting the measure that any draft of mine would undergo a more severe scrutiny and criticism in Congress than one of his composition. Fourthly and lastly, and that would be the reason enough if there were no other, I had a great opinion of the elegance of his pen and none at all of my own.
So,
how wonderful is that?
It's a wonderful recollection. Adams was absolutely right on the first three. It was important that a Virginian rather than a New Englander do it, a Southerner rather than a Northerner. He was obnoxious,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It's hard for me to imagine John Adams admitting that Thomas Jefferson could write 10 times
just not
better
in his
than
character.
Me. Now, I will say that Jefferson, Jefferson saw that recollection of Adams, because he had also written it to a letter to a fellow New Englander, and Jefferson said, "No, that wasn't it. I was elected chair of the committee. There was no we didn't have a discussion about this. I was going to be write the declaration." Although, you know, it's interesting. Jefferson and Adams had this very interesting relationship, a brief relationship. In the months coming up to independence, where they really were allies. And then they didn't see one another for a long time. But then during the 1790s, they were political opponents. Jefferson, the leader of the Republican Party, and Adams, the leader of the Federalist Party. And they just broke off relations altogether. But then in the last 20 years of their lives, they have this absolutely inspirational correspondence in which these two great Americans, I know most of your listeners know this, but they died on the same day, July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. Boy, talk about serendipity. You don't get any more serendipitous than that. So they did have a wonderful relationship in the end. And Adams was mostly right about the reason Jefferson was selected.
But not entirely. But we're back to this relationship. You've made some comparisons to today's politicians and the importance of people obviously arguing about things that they care deeply about, but I guess looking for those moments, those opportunities to find common ground.
That's right. And, of course, if there was ever a time when Americans had to find common ground, it was in July of 1776. This war against Great Britain could not have been successful had the colony of Pennsylvania not been part of it. Not only the fastest growing colony in America, but economically the most prosperous. So again, that's where Dickinson's courage comes in. Even though he didn't agree with the decision, he put himself behind the bar, not only supported the decision, but a week later was leading a Pennsylvania battalion of soldiers against the British Army in New Jersey. So there are moments. Maybe the fiscal cliff isn't as important a moment as that decision for independence, but it's still a lesson, I think, worth paying attention
well,
to.
Well, and I wonder whether you're saying, if you can create a country in 22 months, perhaps you can pass immigration or some of these other issues that seem to dog us?
I would think so. My previous book, Plain Honest Men, was a study of the 4 months in Philadelphia during the Constitutional Convention, where, again, you had delegates coming to Philadelphia, not quite the same gathering of strangers because they'd been through the Revolution together, but they had all kinds of differing interests. But ultimately, it was about compromise. Mm. Not all of the compromises were ones that we love, the compromises on slavery, for example. But ultimately, without those compromises, there would not have been a federal union of the United States of America.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have John from Hopewell, New Jersey. John, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in Richard Stockton and the issue of whether he took a parole or a pardon from General Howe. Hmm. And I've heard that the names of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were not made public until February of 1777. And my question is whether or not that's true and whether or not you know whether or not Howe would have known after Stockton was taken, I think, on November 30th of 76, whether or not Howe would have known who he had in his custody at that time and whether or not he gave a pardon or a parole.
John, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
I'm going to have to profess ignorance on the particular relationship between Howe and Richard Stockton. But on your larger question, it's an important question. The delegates voted in favor of independence on July 4th, but New York had to abstain because its legislature hadn't yet authorized its delegates to vote in favor. They did that on July 9th, and the New Yorkers then quickly added their support of independence. But the document wasn't put on parchment until sometime in August. And the document wasn't signed on parchment. It was signed kind of sporadically. Hmm. If you look at the order in which the signatures appear on the document, they're not in the strict order colony to colony to colony. They're in the order in which they were signed. So there's a delegate from New Hampshire who doesn't sign it, I think, until November of 1776, because he doesn't get there until then. And you're quite right. This was treason. And so the delegates were a little uneasy about having that those signatures made public until they were sure that all of their colonies, now independent states, were fully behind this effort. By the way, it's Richard Stockton who is supposedly the person who called John Adams the Atlas of Independence.
There you go. Thanks for the call. Let's see what Nancy has to say. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
My husband is a Philadelphia musician, Hayward Halkins, a descendant of Thomas Hayward from South Carolina, and I'm trying to clear up the family rumor that he was called the Singing Signer.
Oh, the Singing Signer.
And which delegate from South Carolina?
Thomas Hayward?
Thomas Hayward.
Gosh, I'm sorry. Once again, I've failed. And, Thomas Hayward is one of those relatively silent delegates in an otherwise very, very vocal South Carolina delegation. But I'm gonna have to Google that one myself.
yes, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Since you have really dedicated your life to understanding our, you know, the beginnings of this country, does it frustrate you that there's so much ignorance about our own beginnings?
It is amazing.
I mean, it is amazing when you think about it.
One recent poll, for example, says that 71% of Americans believe that the phrase "all men are created equal" appears in the U.S. Constitution rather than in the Declaration of Independence. More than half of Americans, for reasons that I absolutely cannot understand, think that the Declaration of Independence was signed after the Civil War. So, yeah, there is a depressing ignorance in our civic education. But the one thing I say constantly to all of the people all over the country who I talk to about this period and these people who I so love is that it's not about memorizing the provisions of the Constitution or the specifics of the Declaration of Independence. It really is about the stories of the real people who led us to those epical moments, declaring independence and then creating a nation in 1787. And once we see those people as real people with relevance to our lives, we'll understand them better.
Well, Richard Beeman, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. His book is called Our Lives, Our Fortunes, and Our Sacred Honor. And Andrew O'Shaughnessy's book is called The Men Who Lost America. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Assistance today from Emily Bryant. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.